It's the Dearly Departed Podcast, featuring your host, historian Scott Michaels, and filmmaker Mike Dorsey.
From sunny Hollywood, California, I'm Mike Dorsey.
And I'm Scott Michaels.
And this is episode 6. Lucky six of the Dearly Departed Podcast.
I'm just a couple of white chicks sitting around talking.
Oh, man. Death and coffee. Today we're going to be talking about Gilligan's Island, which I love because, you know, the opening line to that famous theme song, which is just sit right back and you'll hear a tale of a fateful trip, could be like the slogan for this whole show.
And that will be the last time it's heard today.
Is it? We're not going to sing the song?
No.
You all know it. One of the things I want to talk about when we get to it is that, that was not the original theme song. And the original song from the original pilot that never aired is out on YouTube. So we'll get to all that. But before we do, hate mail?
Hate mail.
You know what? I had to dig a little bit for this time because we've gotten a ton of positive feedback from this, which is really cool.
Yeah, and we're now averaging over 2,000 downloads per episode. We just crossed 10,000 total. So thank you to everybody.
Thanks, you guys. It's really people. Yeah, I'm thrilled that people like this stuff. Of course, they're not going to tell me they hate it to my face, but
they'll email it to you though, passive aggressively.
Yeah. But this one, I had to stretch a little bit because I was looking for hate mail, and I haven't got any in a while. But what I did was. I went back to our show that we did for E! A couple of years ago, the Hollywood Death Trip, and we were both co-producers, and I hosted the show, and I uploaded it to YouTube. And I'm really proud of this show. I thought it was really pretty cool. I co-hosted with Danielle Harris, the girl from the Halloween movie. She always calls herself the last girl because she was the last one to die. And you know, it's sort of an irreverent take on things. Although
Death Trip.
Yeah,
yeah. It was the vision that we had when we said, "Hey, let's do a TV show."
I'm proud of it.
Yeah, I wanted to do.
Uh-huh.
I know when we first started making our films.
Yeah.
So yeah.
And I was really proud of it. So I posted it up to YouTube, and one of the things that gets the most comments is because we talk about the apartment that Dorothy Stratton lived in towards the end, the one she was murdered in.
The playmate who was girlfriends with Peter Bogdanovich, who was murdered by her ex.
Paul Snyder. She was the playmate of the year in 1980, mm-hmm. and they've made, you know, a couple of movies about her, et cetera. But we'd been telling Danielle and I really dog on this place because it is really a shitty apartment.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a shitty building in a shitty area right next to the freeway.
Yeah.
And
if somebody
knocks
it down, nobody is going to be there to protest.
No, it's really not nice. So, but we, you know, people that don't know that, we're hearing us really dogging on the place, and they really go after me. They just,
why?
You know, how dare you? You know, do you know what squalor even is, you spoiled brat?
Oh.
You know, that's one of the nicer things.
I do know what it is because I've seen that building.
Yeah. Oh, my God. It's hideous.
Nice.
But it's something like, I wonder what your mansion looks like. Wishing she was rich enough to be a snob. Failing. LOL. I wish I could find more of these. Stuck up as fuck, though. That was a good one.
Mm.
Great show, but she killed it with her hair flipping. Valley girl attitude. One thing.
the only part of the podcast.
They
stuck
had,
up as F.
They had, there was one comment that really, that kind of bugged me. There was the only one thing I really objected. Things about that show really made me uncomfortable going in, but I had to own what I was doing because it was what we were doing.
Yeah.
But the one thing I objected to, and the producers insisted it go in there, was that Brittany Murphy's mother's 911 call. And I asked him, please, not to include
it's
that.
Too personal.
So awful.
Yeah.
I mean, I felt like I had the stress of the world on me anyway. I broke down a couple of times while we were filming that because it was so overwhelming. But they, you know, I got a little bit of flack for that. And I don't blame people one bit because, I mean, 911 calls, they're fair game. You know, they're famous people. But that one is gut-wrenching. And I don't think I'd even post that on my website.
Yeah.
It's so awful. But you know, so fair dues. If that's the way they feel, I can't blame them that.
Well,
but
speaking of people objecting to houses that were in that show, remember the Ashton Kutcher related one?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Remember Ashley Ellerin.
You guys, I wasn't there that day, but you, it was behind the Chinese theater, and the owners of the actual house came up and were like, what? They were angry about it, that you were filming there.
We were shooting at night, and I remember they ran out of their house, and they got in their car, and they parked it so the lights were flashing right at us to screw up any
smart
angle.
That's pretty smart, actually. Yeah, I got to kind of give them credit for that, to put lens flare in the lenses and blow
they
out
they kept shouting for Elliot. Now, and he's going to figure into this, Elliot Schwartz, who was one of the guys on the show.
So Elliot Schwartz is the grandson of Sherwood Schwartz,
the creator
of Gilligan's Island. He was a production assistant on Hollywood Death Trip.
So I had a meeting with Lisa, who was the researcher and rights, et cetera, clearance, and John Slaughter. And in the first meeting I had, Elliot was in it. And Lisa says to me after this meeting, you know, Elliot here has a little showbiz connection himself.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, so what is it? He goes, well, my name's Elliot Schwartz. I go, what, like Sherwood Schwartz? He goes, yeah, he was my grandfather. But I said, I got something to show you. And I brought out my phone. It was the tackiest, not tacky. It's just weird. This is going to be funny. I sweep over like really literally like 10 photographs. And in it, I have a picture of Sherwood Schwartz's grave. And on it, I had these little plastic, when they had the Gilligan's Island doll set that was in the 80s. I brought the little Marianne Skipper and Gilligan, and I put pictures on Sherwood's grave. He loved it.
Because I'm like, here's a happy memory for you of your grandpa.
And he told his dad, and he came back with these stills from the movie because my dad wanted you to have these.
Aww.
It was like really cool. So, he thought it was awesome. I thought, oh God, the next day I really regretted it. But no, he was totally cool with it. So, Elliot, if you're listening, hey.
Thank you, Elliot. Well, before we get into anything else.
Oh, wait, one more.
Oh, good.
One more. The only other comment was fake.
I think on the Hall of Fame of hate mail, that's going to go right next to meh.
Fake.
Meh. Hey, man, fake news is like the term of the era.
It's in the dictionary now.
All right, so first let's get into news of the week.
News of the week.
It was a bit of a bloodbath last episode.
Yeah.
So thankfully, not entertaining for us, but thankfully for the world, it was not that bad this week. We lost Scott Walker, the singer, on March 22nd.
You know what's interesting
about Walker Brothers
that song? He did The Sun Ain't Gonna Shine Anymore.
Mm-hmm.
That's their big hit here in America. They were huge in Britain. And one of my pet sort of go-to stories that I love, when I lived in England, I lived in the East End, and the Cray twins are these identical twin brothers that were gangsters that sort of ran the East End, and they had protection rackets, et cetera. But they're held in high regard because the East End was under control with them there.
Mm-hmm.
So, but one of the things that made them legendary is that Ronnie Cray walked into the Blind Beggar Pub in Whitechapel and walked up to a guy named George Cornell.
And this was in the 60s.
Yeah,
66 or something
like
that.
Was it? Okay.
Yeah.
And shot him in the head and left him, you know, at the bar at the Blind Beggar. And supposedly that Walker song was on the jukebox at the time. And here's something interesting. Maybe we'll talk about the Cray twins another time. The Cray twins were the last prisoners ever in the Tower of London.
Wow.
I know. Isn't that wild?
That's amazing.
It was actually a prison until the 60s.
Huh.
Weird. Anyway.
So Scott Walker, anyways, rest in peace.
Yeah.
I know mainly because of the song 30 Century Man that Wes Anderson, I think, used in one of his films, and it was on the soundtrack and kind of had a resurgent.
Okay.
And then the documentary about him is called, I think, Scott Walker, 30 Century Man.
Oh, okay.
That's what it's about. Richard Erdman, who I know, he's a character actor, very prolific. I know mainly because he was Leonard on Community. He was an old man. He was 93. He was old even when he was on Community. He was like this old, like octogenarian student at the community college.
Mm-hmm.
He was this curmudgeon. He was really funny. But he was in a ton of things. He was in Stalag 17. He was in an episode of The Twilight Zone. He appeared on Cheers and the Beverly Hillbillies. Like, he was just one of those guys who was in anything and everything going back like
Stock
70 years.
Stock 60s,
you know?
Yeah.
And then lastly, well, rest in peace, him. And he was 93. And also Deputy Digby. And why is he interesting? Because we just can't go an episode without talking about
the
subject.
No, he's the pencil man.
The pencil man. What's
pencil
that?
Man. Well, he was working in the Manson trial when Manson charged the to the judge with a pencil, supposedly to stab the judge.
Oh.
And this deputy tackled Manson before he could get there. He just jumped right up and got him before.
I mean, saved the judge from potentially being stabbed with a writing utensil.
Lead poisoning. No, Manson.
They say, oh, he saved the judge's life. I'm like, I don't think, Manson wasn't Bruce Lee. I don't
know. No, Manson knew he wasn't going to get up there. He was just playing
it was just
up.
A stunt.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, totally. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But still, pretty cool to go through life as like the guy that tackled Manson in court, right?
You know who the other bailiff was on that case? Like, for real, he was the real bailiff, was Rusty from the People's Court.
Oh, that's right. I remember that. Yeah.
He was genuinely worked on it.
Is that how he got famous? Or, like, is that how he ended up?
Well, everyone, like Bird on Judge Judy, he was a real bailiff. You know, so they just bring him along for the ride, I guess.
I can just see, like, the Manson trial starting. It's like, ba-dun, dun.
Shut up, you're Judge Judy.
All right.
You get Zippo.
So, just sit right back and you hear a tale. Let's get into Gilligan's Island and the main feature.
It's time for the main feature.
So, Gilligan's Island, I can't imagine there's a person on the planet that doesn't know what that is, even, millennials and...
Even
foreigners,
everybody. Except, well, the people in Britain didn't, but the people in Ireland lived for it.
How do people in England? They live on an island.
Yeah, right?
You think they'd be into it.
No, that was just one of the things that never made it. Nanny and the professor made it over there, and Gilligan's Island didn't.
It makes no sense. I would love to see a British remake.
Oh, my God.
That would have been amazing. So it was created by Sherwood Schwartz, who is, a giant in the sitcom history of Hollywood. He also created The Brady Bunch. And also, he was one of those showrunners that kind of became famous in his own right. He was not... A lot of times, showrunners are just kind of in the background.
See, but he was a known figure. Showrunner, right? Is, because a lot of people don't know.
Showrunner,
I didn't.
Well, I guess they wouldn't have called it a showrunner back then, but he was the show creator and kind of ran it, right? He was like the central guy in charge of, this is the creative vision for how this show is going to go, and I'm going to... Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I'm not just being hired on as a producer, and this is just a gig for me to work. Like, he was the driving force behind it, right? Mm-hmm. So that's what kind of separates a showrunner from just a regular old producer or writer or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's all his vision, right?
Yeah.
And his brothers were writers on it.
Yeah.
So the show ran from 1964 to 1967. So in only three seasons, they had almost 100 episodes, which is just, that's just how things were back then.
Yeah.
But season one was 36 episodes, which... for comparison, like a sitcom today, like a Big Bang Theory or Modern Family is like 24 episodes in a season. So they were just cranking them out.
They were. And those guys are getting paid like $2,500 an episode. Right. I mean, they got dookie.
Kind of like, it's kind of like, it's like when we talked about the Addams Family, even though it was only around for a few seasons, because they cranked out so many episodes, they got syndication.
Yeah.
And that's why...
And
they
only,
the
like
the,
but
power.
Only like paid for two reruns,
right?
And
right.
That was it.
Yep. So that's why you hit nearly 100 episodes, you get syndicated, and that's why. I mean, I was growing up, I remember watching it during the daytime. It's always been on television. I think since it aired, basically. TBS had it in the 90s for a while, and then I think the first season got colorized to match the other two seasons.
Oh, I didn't know they did that.
That were shot in color. But if you buy the DVD set, apparently it comes with the first season in the original black and white. So if you're a Gilligan's Island purist,
are there such things?
I don't know, but you can see it in its original black.
I mean,
and white.
There's Gilligan lovers.
And then after it got canceled, there were of course the reunion specials, which were so huge back in the '70s and eighties.
They were the first to do that.
They
were the first to get to have it when they did Rescue from Gilligan's Island. That was. I mean, I look forward to that for like a month.
That's like an event.
Oh, my God. I mean, that was like
they're
one of the
off.
Highest rated, television programs. I mean, probably not anymore, but at the time, for years and years and years, it was like the highest rated or one of the top three. And it was cool, man, to see all those, except for Tina. They had Judith Baldwin show up as the, as the stand-in Ginger. But what a cool, now they kind of lost it when it came to the Harlem Globetrotters.
So there was the Rescue from Gilligan's Island, which was 1978. Then they did a second special a year later called The Castaways on Gilligan's Island, which is like basically Gilligan's Island goes capitalist. It became, they built like a resort on the island and the Powell's owned, and then all the cast members worked for him, but they were also silent partners in it, and it was kind of silly. And apparently that It's claimed on Wikipedia, so, you know, knock on wood, that that actually was a pilot episode. They were thinking about doing kind of a Love Boat type of a thing there.
Yeah.
And having the this resort on Gilligan's Island go on, and just all these celebrity guests would show up at the resort, right? And that's what all the episodes every week would be about. And then the third one was, for some reason, the Harlem Globetrotters on Gilligan's Island, because there was an era when you could just slap the Harlem Globetrotters on something and people would watch it. Their brand was so big. I don't know.
Yeah.
It goes back to like the 70s. The Harlem Globetrotters were a pop culture like force.
The Saturday morning cartoon and television specials.
And they had the crossover. They were on Scooby-Doo.
Yeah. Like, oh, my God.
It just became like this huge thing.
I remember they had that song, Meadowlark. They used to play. That was a top 40 song.
I remember wanting to see them when I was a kid in the 80s. I never did. But I remember them, that they were just like a big deal.
Yeah, they were.
For, you know, a couple of decades. What was notable, I think, about that was that Jim Backus, who played Thurston Howell III, the millionaire, that was one he wasn't going to be in because he had he was very ill by that point in 81, and he had Parkinson's. And so he wasn't in it, and then he insisted that, hey, let me be at least at the end. And so they kind of carted him over there to the stage, and he makes an appearance at the end and says, you guys all did a good job, you know, and it was apparently a very emotional set with him and everybody saying goodbye to him and all that stuff. He went on and lived for years and years after that, but he was ill for like the last decade of his life.
Yeah, they actually wrote two books about him being ill.
Oh, really?
You know, his wife, Henny, and they were like staples, man. They were like 60s legends. They you know, their dinner parties were legendary.
Really?
And Henny Backus was on a couple of shows, but a couple of Gilligan episodes. They were like almost like Jim and Henny Backus were in Don't Make Waves? Waves, the Sharon Tate movie, the one that
really?
She played in Malibu, that supposedly Malibu Barbie.
That's crazy, because Tina Louise was in The Wrecking Crew with Sharon Tate. So like two of the Gilligan's Island actors were in Sharon Tate movies.
You know, the 6 degrees of Sharon Tate.
Exactly. So,
well, wait, before you get into that, can we just talk about the theme song? You started talking about the theme song. So the original one wasn't, they started with And the Rash.
So the original pilot was filmed in November of 1963. It was never shown until TBS premiered it in 1992, just as a fun thing. So what everybody knows is the first episode of Gilligan's Island was actually the second episode that they filmed, because after they made the pilot, which it often happens even today, they completely retooled it. The original pilot, the professor was actually a teacher, and he was played by John Gabriel. Ginger wasn't a movie star. She was a secretary. And then there was another character who was like a blonde, you know, dumb blonde stereotype named Bunny, who was a co-worker of Ginger's. So that Bunny character got removed, Ginger got changed to a movie star, and the teacher character got upgraded to a professor, and they got a new actor to play him.
Hmm.
So that was the, and also the original theme song was sung by Sherwood Schwartz himself. It was way longer.
Is that on YouTube?
It was almost twice. Yeah, and I'm going to link to this. I'll link to this, to the original theme song, because somebody uploaded it. And it's sung by Sherwood Schwartz, and it's kind of a funny calypso voice, singing voice. And he originally it was a 6-hour tour, not a 3-hour tour.
Mm-hmm.
And basically it's nowhere near as good as the theme song that we now know today. It was just very long and it was kind of silly. And
Sherwood, I think he started that whole story in the theme song setup sort of thing. You know, like the Brady Bunch explains everything. Now, something I found was kind of interesting.
Because that was one of the things that I guess he got pushback from the networks, like, hey, how are you going to explain to everybody in every episode?
Oh, and that's why he came up with the...
That's why. He was like, how are you going to explain their situation? How they got... Every week, they're going to be like, how did they get on the island? What are they doing? And he's like, no, we're working into the theme song. So everybody knows, even if you're a new viewer, you're caught up to speed on what the situation is.
Okay. Well, I was listening to... I listened to the classical station here because I dumped my Sirius radio because it sucked.
KUSC or whatever it is?
Yeah. And the other day, something came on. It was the theme song for a movie called Hang 'Em High in 1968. And if you listen to it, I thought it was the classical version of Gilligan.
Oh,
you know,
really?
It goes da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And this was made in 68.
Wow.
So if anyone's ripping anybody off, it was somebody ripping off Sherwood.
Oh, and one other thing. The original theme song was supposedly written by John Williams, the great music composer.
Oh, he did Lost in Space.
Yeah, and some of the incidental music that still was in the show was music that he wrote for that show. Yeah, just the regular random stuff that played in the back. Yeah. So Gilligan's Island, one of the great television theme songs, do you think it's like the best? Is it like the gold standard for sitcom intros
for sung for ones that with words, probably.
Yeah,
yeah.
I mean,
it's certainly
the
most iconic to my generation. The next generation would be the Bradys.
Yeah, and I would put on the Mount Rushmore of sitcom intros. I would also put the Golden Girls song. Oh. Thank you for being a friend. Come on, that's amazing. Stop. It's so good.
I don't think I've ever sat through an episode. I seriously.
Oh, come on.
No, I'm dead serious.
I love the insults.
I will
so
turn
good.
In my gay card, but no, I can't deal. But I could tell you a story about B. Arthur if you want to hear it.
Of course. Anytime Scott says I can tell you a story, say yes.
Well, so again, this goes back to my ex and in London and sitting in a green room. And there's a word that you're going to have to beep out of here. Can you beep?
Yes.
Okay. So B. Arthur was back in the green room, and she had killed a bottle of Absolut Lemon in 45 minutes.
What?
On the rocks. I swear on my life, I have the bottle in the shop. I saved it. And for some reason, I started talking to her, and there was a few of us, and we talked about a friend of hers that was a drag queen named Charles Pierce, who was legendary. And then I asked her about Golden Girls, and she said, I told her I remembered more from the theme song from Maude than I do from my American history class. I retained more from there. And then she, of course, clicked her tongue and rolled her eyes because she thought I was ridiculous. But then I asked her about Golden Girls, and she says, Rue and I have been friends forever, mm-hmm. and she is my rock. She goes, but Betty is a
really?
I swear on my life. She said it twice. Wow. And she hated Betty White's guts.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
Betty White, who's now like one of the most beloved the only elderly,
the only one
who lived.
Yeah. Did I tell you we made a prank phone call to Betty White once?
It pays to be hated, I guess.
Well, B was the only one that hated her.
Right.
You know, and I think
it was a personal beef.
She broke the fourth wall, and I think that bugged B, because like during breaks she'd talk to the audience, and B was an old pro. You know, she's like Broadway. And she was a truck driver in the Marines too. Anyway, mm-hmm. we could talk about that later. But I thought you'd appreciate
that. We have
that.
To do a Golden Girls episode now. You realize that?
Yeah,
a show that you don't like.
Right?
Yeah.
What a I love his story.
That's hilarious. I mean, I would put that. I would put the Cheers theme song for sure on that.
You know,
there.
As far as music goes, I think one of the greatest themes ever made musically was the Lost in Space theme song. Mm-hmm. Both of them, man. They were John Williams, again, the Star Wars guy, and he and Indiana Jones and Superman, etc. But yeah, that's a really great theme song, both of them, or theme music, we'll say. But they weren't that often. They weren't the sing-song ones weren't.
Well, they got big in the 90s sitcom, 80s and 90s sitcoms, like Growing Pains had a big sing-along one.
Wait, did thank you for
Facts
being
of,
a friend.
Facts of Life is one of the great ones.
Did they? But was it just a theme song, or did they explain the premise of the
That's
show?
A good point. Not so much, no. It was more like the vibe of the show as opposed to specifically telling you what the show was about.
Yeah.
So even Cheers, I don't think, really talked about it's a bar. It's just, you know, you want to go somewhere where everybody knows your name and having a good time.
Yeah. Right?
It could have been about almost anything.
A comfort song.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. It sets it up. Right, I get it. It sets the feel.
But it doesn't tell you they're on an island, this is how they got there, and go.
Yeah. Yeah, but that was one of the things. When they filmed that second episode, the one we know is the first, I remember reading in a couple of their books that when they got on that... island. They were literally, I think, the opening scene on an island in Hawaii. That was when JFK was assassinated.
Oh,
and they
really?
Were all sitting there
that
going,
be the time
no,
it would be right. Yeah.
We got to do this funny show. And they're all sitting around, and they just got news that JFK was killed.
That's crazy.
And they had to go ahead with this wacky show on that day. And they did start, the original theme was And the Rest. It wasn't until season two that they added the professor and Marianne.
Yeah, and what was it? One of the actors pushed for that. Is it Hale? I want to say
I don't think. I think maybe Sherwood just sort of.
I read somewhere that Hale or one of the guys are the ones that pushed, hey, you should mention Marianne and
I could see
whatever.
That happen. I could see Ellen Hale doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it became a joke for years when you met them. And it was like, oh, we're And the Rest.
So there's one more story I wanted to tell before we get into the deaths. And this is just a fascinating story I came across. So in 1961, just a few years before Gilligan's Island happened, there was an FCC chairman who had been appointed by JFK. speaking of JFK, and he gave a really famous speech about the state of the television industry called Television in the Public Interest. It's considered one of the like more famous speeches in American history. And he gave it to the National Association of Broadcasters convention, which is called NAB, which to this day is still a huge convention in the television industry. And he basically trashed television. He got up in front of the television industry and told them they were horrible. And part of his speech was... when television is good, nothing, not the theater, not the magazines or newspapers, nothing is better. But when television is bad, nothing is worse. And he goes on to just trash it, you know, that it's all violence and cowboy shows and mayhem and stupid family comedies with families that are unbelievable, blah, blah, blah. And he calls it that he famously called television a vast wasteland. So...
things have changed a lot.
That's what's so funny is what he says about television, you could say today. Usually. Yeah. It hasn't changed. And so, I mean, he was kind of lobbying for television should be like PBS. It should be educational. It should be for the public good. News shouldn't be about ratings, which I agree with. It should be about giving us the news that's important, things like that. But what I'm telling this story is that a couple of years after this guy launches this brutal attack on Sherwood's industry and the type of show that Sherwood wants to make and works on, Sherwood makes this show called Gilligan's Island. And what was the name of the FCC chairman that gave this speech? His name was Newton Minow.
Oh, that's hilarious.
And so that's why...
that's his big FU.
That's why the SS Minow, the wrecked ship, is named after the FCC chairman.
That's very cool. Oh, good for Sherwood.
Isn't that amazing? But Newt Minow, the guy, the FCC chairman, he had a crazy career in life. He was a well-respected attorney. He was Adlai Stevenson's aide. In the 50s, and he in 1988 recruited a young man to be his summer associate at his law firm, and that young man happened to be Barack Obama.
Really?
He gave Barack Obama basically his first job when he was a first year law student, and he introduced Barack Obama to his supervisor, a young attorney at this law firm, who was Michelle.
Wow.
So he literally introduced the Obamas to each other. And then right before Obama left office, he awarded Minow the Presidential Medal of Freedom just a couple months before he...
how fascinating.
So, isn't that wild?
Yeah.
And Minow is still alive. He's in his 90s. And,
really?
You know, and all of his kids are respected lawyers and are connected. And one of them, I think, is the dean of Harvard Law, has been. So he's kind of this fascinating character from, you know, 60s politics that there aren't a whole lot of them left that knew all those guys, you know?
People, you know, it's funny. The show Gilligan's Island, you know, had a little bit more depth to it. I mean, the seven castaways were to represent the seven deadly sins.
Well, that's
you know,
interesting.
Tina Louise was vanity. The skipper was gluttony. And I can't, you know, obviously, I don't know what the
Gilligan
term would be
was
for.
Gilligan was sloth. I would imagine.
And the howls would be,
greed.
Greed.
Yeah.
You know, so they do. And and they were really so convincing that the Coast Guard was actually getting calls saying these poor seven people are out on that island. Why can't you save them? It's true. These things did happen.
People thought television was real. They really did.
It's like Granny on Gilligan on the you know, she saw the boat going on the TV. She thought there was somebody, the boat's in her television. I love that.
That's like what was it, that movie My Girl with Macaulay Culkin?
Yeah,
and the his little female friend is she's going to run away from home to go to Hollywood to live with I think the Brady Bunch. Because she thinks that that's, you know, a real family.
I would. Oh, my God. That's why these people captivated us. I mean, they were our friends growing up.
Right.
These are the guys we spent all this time with. And they never judged us. We just got to go and immerse ourselves in their lives for, you know, 26 minutes or whatever it was at that point.
And because of syndication, like, you know, I had a girlfriend in college who was a hardcore Brady Bunch fan. She had, like, the lunch pail and knew all the episodes and stuff, because even though we were 80s kids, like, she grew up watching it just like kids in the 60s and 70s did.
Damn.
You know?
Lunch pail, Mike. I'm guilty of it. I say that too. But
what is it supposed to be? Lunchbox?
Yeah, lunchbox. I always say that.
Lunch pail, isn't it? People, but I guess lunchbox is probably
back
more...
in the Walton's day, it was lunch pail.
You got your thermos in your lunch pail.
Yeah, no, it's lunch. No, I'm there. I say the same. I say tin foil, and I say there's a lot of things that I say that are kind of outdated, but that's one of the funny ones.
So you want to get into death?
Sure. So the first
chronological order.
Yeah. So
Backus.
We got Jim Backus. He was the first one to go. Now the
and
last,
he was Thurston Howell III. He was a billionaire. Yeah.
He was I don't know. There was back in 1988. There was a show, a talk show on Fox. I think I forget what year it was that Fox was launched. But I remember Joan Rivers was the first talk show on Fox, and she was shit canned like really short period after that because of the ratings. But I think it was Fox. Ross Matthews was a LA DJ, I think, had a talk show. And the last time the seven castaways were in a room together alive was on Ross Matthews' show in '88. And it's on YouTube. It's really cool. And Jim was clearly, you know, towards the end because he died a year later. Yeah. But it was all of them were there. Even Tina Louise showed up for it, which is shocking because she is so Tina. And Tina
was the one that revolted the most.
She was revolting the most.
Yeah, she's the one. She's the one that, you know, was the most upset about being typecast.
She's the proverbial "don't you know who I am" person though too. She's so that way. And I heard that Jane Mansfield auditioned to be Ginger Grant. I don't know if that's true or not. I find that difficult, but it is stated as fact.
There
in a
is
lot
some
of
other
places.
Tina Louise Jane Mansfield connection too. Yeah. That goes back to like modeling and stuff. I think. Yeah. So. Tying back to our last episode, episode 5 about Rebel, Jim Backus was James Dean's father in Rebel Without a Cause.
And he was really, that passive. And Jimmy was, you know, you say something to her when his mother was really lambasting Jim Backus. Mm-hmm. You say something, you stick up for yourself.
and he was also the voice of Mr. Magoo for decades.
Yeah. God, he did a lot of stuff, didn't he? He's
it's almost like the older actors, they couldn't be typecasted because they'd already had long careers.
Yeah.
You know, he was already involved, I think, with Mr. Magoo by the time this happened, so he just kept doing that. Yeah. So he couldn't be typecasted because he was already involved in other things. You know what I mean?
Yeah. He was a great character actor, even though he only really played one character. he was a 60s fixture. He and his wife Henny were fixtures of the 60s on television and in life. They were pretty cool. It's of the cocktail generation.
Right.
Yeah.
And so he died from pneumonia.
And he's at Westwood. Pneumonia due to that. It's a bacteria called Klebsiella or something like that.
We're not doctors.
Klebsiella or something like that. But it's a bacteria that most of us can live with. But that's what contributed to his pneumonia.
It seems like elderly people, a lot of times, pneumonia is what they have a lot of other problems, and pneumonia kind of finishes them off. Yeah.
All right. Okay, so the next one is Alan Hale Jr.
Well, a year after Backus, 1990, at age 68.
Remember his name on the show? His real name on the show? His character name?
Yeah, they only said it like once.
Yeah.
Well, I don't remember.
Jonas Grumby.
That's right, Grumby. Because he's like grumpy.
I guess. Right? I don't know. But it was Grunby, so right. I don't know. But he was, I mean, talk about a likable guy. He was a fixture in L.A. He had he had a restaurant in La Cienega.
Yeah, it was called Alan Hale's Lobster Barrel, the most barrel. 70s name for a surf and turf. You get let's go to the Lobster Barrel.
And he was always there.
Yeah, he would be there. There's tons of stories about people going there, and like he would, you know, he was there in his skipper's hat, and he would hang out with you while you ate. Even he would just chill with you, and he's at the bar, you know, because it goes to a lot of these guys being typecasted, and they got to make a living still. So there's people like Tina Louise who rebelled against it.
And what happened to her?
Right. And then there's, you know, Bob Denver and Alan Hale stuff. They leaned into the Gilligan and Skipper thing and was like, well, this is how I'm going to be known. Yeah. So we'll try to find a way to capitalize on it, right? Yeah.
Yeah, it just seemed like, you know, I don't know if he was a bar fly, but I knew they knew him well at the Formosa. I knew they knew him well at the Frolic Room. Mm-hmm. So he was a well-known fixture in the bars, you know, in the 60s and the 70s. And you're right, he totally embraced the whole Gilligan thing. And there's a story I got to tell you. I got a lot of personal stories about these people because I adore these people.
I cannot tell you how excited I would be if I was like, I'm going to go to Alan Hale's Lobster place tonight, and he's going to be there, and I'm going to freaking hang out with him. Do you know how cool that would be? Like, nobody does that.
Let me tell you a story, though. You'll flip when you hear this one, seriously. So back when I lived in Chicago for about 9 years, and this has been about 1990, there was a radio station, WCKG, that would have events. You know, they would have write in, and you win a ticket. And what the event was a three-hour tour with the Castaways. So I had everybody in my office. I must have had 50 people write in because I was going to this thing, you know. And it turns out like 10 of these people won, including myself. So it was myself, and I took my friend Bun as her nickname. And what we did was we got on a boat, and went on the Chicago River. Now, Bun and I are total fans, and we nerded out. I mean, we made SS Minnow jeans, and we made Gilligan jackets, and we brought Lay's, and we made coconut cups. I mean,
you were as obnoxious about it as you could possibly.
But it was
be.
Before the internet, so anyway, so we're out on the Chicago River. And an hour into this 3-hour cruise, you look on the shore and you see flares going up. And we trudge over to the shore and stop, and they pull down the little walkway, and Marianne and Gilligan and the skipper and the professor walked on the ship.
What?
And the band starts in with the Gilligan's Island theme song, and everybody's singing the song, and these four people come in on the boat. It's like I got goosebumps talking about this day. It was the coolest, cool. So for the next 2 hours, you hung out with the castaways on the ship, and they would sit and they'd talk to you. They you can answer questions, you can get autographs, you could do, and they were just chill about it. And I remember when they walked in, and they walked right past me, of course, because I was up at the front, and we were both, Bun and I were in front, and Alan Hale walked right by me, he's about 5 feet away from me, and as he's walking past, I reach out my hand, I go, thank you so much, and he looked at me, he goes, no, thank you, and now it's like, you can see I'm going to get teary-eyed right now, because it was like the coolest thing. They were all so really nice, and Bun and I, the favorite episode is the honeybees, I don't know if you remember that, but the girl group.
I don't remember that one.
The girls, there was a rock band that got stranded or went to the island called the Mosquitoes, and they were really popular, and the girls wanted to be rescued, so they decided to create a band called the Mosquitoes, the Honeybees. And we gave Dawnwell a little honeybee, and she said, I'm going to put this on my Christmas tree. And interestingly enough, she had an estate sale a couple of months ago that I went to, and a whole tub of Christmas decorations, and I dug through that thing.
Trying to find your bee.
But we didn't find it.
It meant too much to her. She kept it.
Maybe. I like to think so.
Right.
But man, I tell you, that was a night I'll never, ever forget.
Well, and I read a story online that someone that went to Alan Hale's restaurant as a kid said he was there, and he was a little kid, and Alan Hale, rustled his hair and said, how you doing, little buddy?
Oh, neat.
So that's what he would do, I guess, if you're a little kid and you walk in there, he'd call you little buddy like he called Gilligan.
That's
right?
So he knew the story, man. He loved it. He just loved it. He ate it up.
And then what I find really funny, and he must have known the irony of this, he started, right before he died, maybe a year or so before, he started a travel agency.
Did he?
Yes. Which he must have known, like, the skipper of the most famous shipwrecked group of people in history starting a travel agency, I think, is really funny.
That's really funny. I wonder if it were cruises,
That would be awesome.
But he, the other thing he used to do on his own was he'd visit kids in hospitals. And he'd
dress up.
Yeah, as a skipper. Well, he always wore that anyway.
And Gilligan was forever damned, Bob Denver was forever damned to walk around in a bucket hat.
Yeah.
There was no way around it, right?
Yeah. And the one story Sherwood told, and he said, this is at Alan Hale's funeral. Sherwood Schwartz told the story, and I'm going to read it because I can't quote it verbatim. But it says, Sherwood says, there was a boy of about 10 who just had a kidney removed. Alan debated whether he should go see the boy. And just then the doctor came along and said, go ahead, he's waking up. So Alan Hale Jr. went in, and the boy looked up in disbelief and said, Skipper? And Alan said, that's right, son, the skipper's here, and everything's going to be all right. Isn't that why? Another with the teary moments, that was so sweet. Could you imagine being that guy, that kid? Oh, man,
how much better could you have felt as a kid, to have someone like that?
That kind of reassurance, up, right? Very cool.
Is that it for Alan? Oh, he died from thymus cancer.
He did. His wife held his hand, and supposedly he watched the sun go down from his window in the room, and he just fell asleep.
Wow.
His wife Trinket, that was her nickname. They've been married since the 60s. And and I wrote her a note, a really sweet note. He lived on Orange Grove, like right off of Sunset. And his huge Cadillac would always be parked in the driveway. Even for like 10 years after he died, that Cadillac would still be in that driveway. I guess Trinket still drove. But I wrote her a nice note, and I wrote her a note, and she sent me a nice note back.
So that's nice.
Yeah. Little Trinket Hale.
So after he died, his ashes were spread at sea in the Pacific, of course.
Of course. By boat. And Marianne was there.
Oh, really? Yeah, that's right. She went.
Yeah.
Marianne, really, she was kind of the glue, I feel like. She kind of seems the one that kind of stayed good friends with everybody afterwards.
Yeah. I think she wasn't real show business. I don't think she did a few things, but I don't think she was the seasoned actor or actress. So I think her heart was in this more so than the others.
Right. Next up, again, a year later, there was like a bad couple of years here for Gilligan's Island castmates. Natalie Schaefer, Mrs. Howell, died in 1991 at the age of 90. And what I find amazing is she lied about her age her entire life to the point where her friends didn't even know what her age was until after she died. She was born in 1900. She was actually 13 years younger than Mr. Howell, than Bacchus. Who played her husband.
In real life?
Yeah.
I know she was in her 60s when they made the episode. She was already postmenopausal when they made the pilot.
Right.
And I remember the story she told was that she was cast for the pilot, and she was thrilled because it was a trip to Hawaii, you know, as a paid vacation.
Right. She's and like, whatever. Even if this doesn't take, I get a trip to Hawaii.
Yeah. And then she got the call that it was bought, and she started crying because she didn't want to do it. Which is, because she's an accomplished actor. Right. She'd done a lot of things.
And she did soaps afterwards, too, in her old age. She never shed that wealthy socialite image of her character on Gilligan's after that.
She was in Day of the Locust, though. She played a madam in that movie.
So the very last TV appearance that her and Bacchus made together was an Orville Redenbacher commercial in 1989,
which is the same year.
And it's on YouTube. I found it, so we'll post a link to it.
That's cool.
But you can see Bacchus, had the tremors. Even in the commercial.
Tremors.
And kind of white tremors from the Parkinson's.
Tremors, not tremors. Okay. I thought you meant like ear hair tremors.
I don't know that. Tremors. Oh, you're. Yeah. No, tremors like the shakes.
Yeah.
He could tell Parkinson's. Kind of the wider shots he's holding his hands to keep from, shaking because he was in the late stages of Parkinson's.
It's interesting to watch people do that. Michael J. Fox does it. William Frawley did it in I Love Lucy.
And they had the medication that helps them for a time at least not have the problem with it. Yeah. But it's an interesting commercial because they're basically playing their characters.
Cool.
It's a really cool piece of, and Orville's there.
Yeah. They pay for the rights of that, but she lived on Rodeo Drive, her house unfortunately was torn down, but she had a nice house, a nice pink house on Rodeo Drive. At the end, Dawn Wells was for a while. Dawn did a lot of strange things after she died. Not bad things at all. She started a company called Wishing Wells, and she made clothing for people that were didn't have mobility. So if you were like in a hospital bed, bedridden, these clothes you could slip on and off and the backs were open, kind of like hospital clothes, but they were nice clothes. And Natalie Schaefer was her model in all the promotional ads for it. But Wishing Wells is what it was called. And she was well liked. They had a nice memorial service for her in her house. She died April 10th, 1991.
And she was 90, and she apparently did a lot of real estate investments that were good, and she was pretty wealthy. I mean, she was definitely a millionaire, well into her millions, and she left a few million to charity, and there's a rumor that she left some of her fortune to Marianne.
Probably gave her something, because they were pretty close.
Yeah, and she's always, refused to talk about it, of course, for privacy reasons.
Yeah.
But supposedly some of her estate went to her.
At the Motion Picture Country Home in Woodland Hills, there is a Natalie Schaefer building. She left a ton of money to the Motion Picture Country Home. And so they have a whole big Natalie Schaefer wing. And then she was scattered like Alan Hale off of Point Furman.
And like Hale, she died from cancer. She had a liver cancer at the end.
Natalie's last words, "I'm going to take a pain pill."
Let those be all of our last words.
I know, right? In fact, just before this show.
I'm going to take a bunch of Vicodin. See you when I wake up.
Atta girl.
Go out on a high note. We are not endorsing opiate use on this show, but just it's funny.
I don't condone it, but I understand it.
So Bob Denver, Gilligan. So the world got a break in castaway deaths for over a decade. In 2005, Bob Denver, who was Gilligan, passed away at the age of 70. And talk about drugs.
Yeah, well, he was a high brain. I mean, it was dope was his thing, I think, wasn't it?
He was a pothead, man.
Yeah.
Supposedly he had two marijuana busts. One of them was for having marijuana delivered to his house.
And by who?
Which is very 2019.
Yeah.
Supposedly.
It's true.
So supposedly, Don Wells supposedly had sent him the drugs. And then he supposedly told the police that when he first, got busted for it. But then he wouldn't He denied it and wouldn't assist with any prosecution, yeah. So nothing was ever done.
They were both potheads. Dawn was a total. She got arrested too for pot.
Oh, really?
And yeah, Dawn supposedly shipped him a bunch of pot, and not with her return address on it, obviously.
That's so funny.
Back when pot was still illegal, because it's here when it was before it was legal, you could just go, oh, I can't sleep, and they give you a prescription and you go get it.
And now you can walk down like next door to 7-Eleven down the street is definitely a pot shop.
You described it like a Mac store, that one over in West Hollywood.
Everywhere.
You go in, oh, what I'm looking for is this thing. I can go to sleep, but I want a little bit of a buzz, a tiny bit of psychedelic. I've got just
the thing.
And I
have a sore muscle sometimes in the mornings. I know exactly the strain you need.
But back before then, I was sending like pot gummies to friends of mine in other states, and I would just put like porn stars' return addresses on a Vivid Entertainment.
Really?
It's like, what are they going to do? But anyway,
that is so funny. Freaking FedEx wouldn't even let me ship a wine bottle one time.
Really?
Like, yes, I was stupid enough to tell them what it was. That's the problem. You try to ship alcohol over state lines and. People
really?
Get all mad. Yeah. That's why, you know, my parents or my mom, when she used to ship wine like back to relatives back east, she would say it was canned fruit.
Yeah.
Because technically.
It's a case of lithium batteries.
It's canned fruit that just happened to have fermented.
Yeah.
I guess in fact
that if it broke, then it would make sense. Because if that broke, it'd be a hell of a mess.
Well, also it was illegal.
Certain states,
because of alcohol laws that probably go back to the Prohibition era. That should be overturned. Yeah, you can't. Certain states can't ship alcohol to other certain states. I don't know. Exactly,
you know, alcohol laws are so weird. In Detroit, we had you had to stop selling at 2 a.m. on Christmas Eve. You had to stop at 6 p.m. and you couldn't buy again until the day after Christmas. It's so crazy.
Alcohol makes baby Jesus upset.
Well, the other day, I was getting a bottle of wine at Vons, and I stood in the self-checkout line, and you check ID or whatever.
Right.
No, you got to go. You cannot buy in the self-checkout line.
They just don't let you do it at all, right?
No, the woman was right there. I go, here's my ID. No, I'm sorry. You got to take it and go over there in that
line.
I'm
not authorized to check your identification for your alcohol. Yeah.
I've
been on productions in, you know, the Bible Belt where there are still dry counties, which I thought was a thing that disappeared in like the 40s.
Yeah, like Tennessee
there's
and stuff
still,
like that. Yeah.
Well, they make Jack Daniels is made in a dry county. So you can go on the Jack Daniels tour of the distillery and you can do like a shot of whiskey. At
can you sample
whatever.
It there?
Yeah, you can sample it. But there's the county itself is a dry county. And it's so weird the way it works. Some of the counties, there's like one place you can buy alcohol for some reason. But you can't buy it anywhere else. It's very strange. But then, you know, you drive around town and all of a sudden you hit this street that's like all mega churches and you realize, oh, well, that's where the political power is in this community. And that's why they still have.
It's not political. It's God.
Yeah. They still have, you know, alcohol. They still have alcohol prohibition. And what's so dumb is, of course, what then happens is everybody drives 30 miles away to the next county, gets drunk, and then you got a bunch of drunk drivers on the road coming home. So it's just. It's silly, but whatever.
I know that in Canada you have to go to state stores. They call them state stores, I think. And only during business hours.
And in Utah, there's like caps on the alcohol percentage of beers, I think, that are sold in bars. And there's some weird stuff about that. And then what's hilarious is then you go to France and you walk into a grocery store and there's literally a sommelier in the wine section at like what they consider a Ralph's. Yeah. And he's there to like help you make your selection. And you're like, he's like, what do you want? And how soon are you going to drink it? Are you going to store this? Are you going to drink it right now? What's your price range? Okay, here you go. Take this bottle. And here it's like.
I was home in Detroit and I went to a store to buy, booze or whatever for a party. And they were handing out shots of this like Fruit Loops flavored vodka. I mean, it's like people got to get back in their cars. You know, like roadside wine tasting is a thing in Michigan. But how do you get insurance for things like
this? I love they're the drive-through liquor stores, right?
Yeah. I mean, they were giving us shots and then, okay, bye. And you're pulling out of their parking lot. It's like, how do you get insured?
Or you go into like a nice clothing store and they're like, you want some champagne? And you're like,
What kind of clothing stores do you go to? They don't have those at Kohl's.
Or beer. The Marshalls doesn't offer me beer. What are you talking about? So anyways, that was a nice tangent. Bob Denver got us started on this whole like.
Good old Bob. Oh, poor Bob. Well, he was in another one, you know, Gilligan's real name.
Oh, this one I don't know.
Willie. It was Willie Gilligan.
And while we're on the subject, what was the professor's real name?
You want me to tell you?
It was told once on like a radio. they intercepted like a radio broadcast about them being missing, and his name was told. Well, I don't remember.
Roy Hinckley. Bob Denver was literally Sherwood opened up a phone book and pointed to a name and came up with Gilligan.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. But yeah,
and
they were
named a whole show after that name. Yeah.
You know, and Tina Louise thought it was going to be her show. She thought she was going to be the star of it.
Because she's the movie star.
Right.
Really? Even though it's called Gilligan's Island. It's not called Movie Star's Island.
Right.
It's not called Ginger's Island.
No, it isn't.
Oh, my gosh. So we have a crazy-ass story about Gilligan, about Bob Denver.
That is crazy.
That, again, goes back to our time making Hollywood Death Trip.
Yeah.
And one of the producers told us a story about him, and it was a... As I wish I could remember it better, but as I recall, it was like a reality type show, one of these kind of MTV Road Rules type of a shows, and they were on an island, like in the Bahamas or something like that, and they thought, oh, we're on an island, and it's kind of like a Survivor-esque type of an episode, so let's have Gilligan, let's have Bob Denver come here and be Gilligan, and he'll be like the celebrity judge at the end who tells who the winner is or something like that, right? So they had him fly in, and they sent like a production assistant to go pick him up at the airport, and it was just a disaster.
Oh, my God. He was, I mean, a total high brain, total high brain. I guess he was just out of control.
He kept like, they sent like a limo or something, and he was like hanging out the sky.
I forgot about
he was
these
like
details.
Hanging out the moonroof, and he was like yelling at people, like getting them, that's Gilligan, right? And he kept making them stop at like bars and liquor stores, and they kept calling, like, where is he? Where is he? And he was like, I can't, this production system, like, I can't control him.
I
like,
forgot all about this. That is such a cool story.
We're going where he wants to go.
He was just belligerent. Well, you know, good on him. What the hell? They're paying him. He didn't give a shit.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, what are you going to do? Tell him no?
Yeah, no Gilligan.
Yeah.
No. Well, poor him.
You hire Gilligan, you get Gilligan. Like, that's just what you get, you know?
He had a rough life. I mean, you know, he had a decent career. I mean, he had Far Out Space Nuts, for gosh sake, one of the Sid and Marty Krofft shows. But he had a son that was born with autism.
Right. And there's the Bob Denver Association, what is it, Bob Denver Organization or something like that as a charity.
For autism.
Or the Denver Organization
or something.
Yeah.
And the poor kid was, you know, didn't speak until he was like six or something. And he kept it to himself. I didn't know about this till after he died. So, because he left show business and he went back to wherever he was living at the time. I know they lived in Hawaii for a while. And then I think he died in North Carolina.
I was going to say he was back east somewhere.
Yeah.
I think. Yeah.
And, he just laid low. And nobody really knew that until after he died.
And he's another guy. He died of pneumonia.
But he had heart bypass surgery.
He had heart problems. He also had cancer issues.
Throat cancer. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Poor Gilligan. Rest in peace.
Rest in peace, Bob Denver. And then we got to mention in this order Sherwood Schwartz, who passed away in 2011. His cause of death was being 94.
He was so well loved.
He died in his sleep peacefully, which is how you would want any beloved person like him to
At Cedars.
Pass. Yeah. Yep.
One of the many.
So I thought this was interesting. You know, we talked about the Addams Family and we talked a little about the Munsters. His son created the Munsters Today, a reboot of the Munsters in the late 1988 to 1991.
Was that the one with like Tim Curry or Eddie Izzard or something?
Can't remember.
I don't remember. I know Eddie Izzard did one.
So it starred John Shuck
as Herman,
Lee Merriweather, Jason Marsden.
James Marsden?
No.
Jason. It must be his father or something.
No, it may possibly. And then I don't know. I don't know.
And
the rest.
I saw Elroy. He did a show called The Nerd with Charles Nelson Reilly at a theater in Chicago that I went to see, and I met Elroy there. Such nice people, the Schwartzes.
So where was he buried?
He's at Hillside Cemetery in Culver City. Sherwood is near Vic Morrow from the Twilight Zone movie, the Rotary Club member.
The helicopter parent.
Right. And Al Jolson and Shelley Winters and Aaron Spelling, they're all in there. But Sherwood, there was a theater in Chicago called The Annoyance. And it was the Soloway sisters. This is like low tech. This is when they first started doing stuff. There was like Charles Manson, the musical. They did the real live Brady Bunch for the first time. And they were doing verbatim, not ironically, Brady Bunch scripts, just word per word. Now, Jill Soloway's huge here. I mean, she did, you know, 6 Feet Under, and she did a movie, a show about. She's a lesbian. She's a lesbian. Transparent was one of hers too, but with Jeffrey
Tambor.
Yes. Jeffrey Tambor. One
Tambor. That's
right. Yeah. So anyway, the word for word Brady Bunch scripts, and it became a thing. Like Eve Plum flew in and did a role as in the Johnny Bravo episode, and then one day Sherwood came in and they flew him in for it, and he, because they were worried about rights, because they were, you know, it was a proper theater production, they were selling tickets and doing Brady Bunch scripts, but Sherwood came in for it and he just loved it. I was at that one particular show, and I did a rerun of my Gilligan jacket that I wore on the ship with the castaways, but it was really, really cool. Going to see Sherwood, him watching Brady Bunch episodes, and real-life Brady Bunch, that ran for years here in L.A. Mm. That was a cool idea.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I said cool Gilligan stories, man. Those are cool.
There's a lot of stuff like that in Hollywood where a lot of these guys, like Dan Harmon, who did Community, has been doing kind of live event shows for forever. There's a lot of other kind of comedic actors out there. If you know how to get in with it, they do like cool little live events around Hollywood. You just kind of have to know that they're doing it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then lastly, the most recent cast member to pass away was Russell Johnson, who was the professor, who died in 2014 at the age of 89.
Another really nice guy. Very quiet, very soft-spoken man.
He seems like he would be.
Yeah, and decent. Mm-hmm. Just a decent guy. He literally moved to an island off of Washington State, just out of
really?
Seattle. Yeah,
how beautiful, though.
Yeah. Yeah, and he actually had a son named Dave who was in the 70s. He was at coordinating like gay rights groups at his college, and he was appointed by Mayor Tom Bradley to head his like first AIDS awareness sort of group organization for the city of L.A. And Russell was always really big into gay rights and
supporting his son and all that. Yeah,
really cool. So when he died, his cemetery was at Valhalla, North Hollywood. I don't know if that's where his son's buried. I think he is, but
that's right. His son died from AIDS complications a few years after his partner had passed away. From the same
back in '94. And this is back when when there was nothing.
Only magic had a chance at.
Right.
Back then, yeah.
That was a scary time.
And he also flew, he was a bombardier in World War II in a B-25. He flew 44 combat missions in the South Pacific.
Wow.
Which is amazing.
Yeah.
And if you know anything about bomb crew, especially, at least
you
in the
would.
Year,
I mean, was it
my grandfather was a B-26 pilot in Europe. I mean, your odds of survival were not good. It's amazing how many of these guys we've come across now that were, you know, didn't just serve in the war, but were in combat roles in the war, like very easily could not have made it home.
Right.
You know, like Jimmy Stewart is another one of those guys that like refused to kind of be held back.
He went straight to the front lines, didn't he? Bob Hope, who went, you know, entertaining.
Like some of the guys,
Some of the guys. Although there's a place for that.
So. Sure. Some of the guys, though, they went for the publicity factor of it, and that's how the military used them to raise money for the war bonds and stuff like that. But, some of these guys, they put themselves right into the line of fire, which is pretty cool.
Those were the days, man, when people, I'm guilty of it, too. It's like everyone feels... doesn't really care, you know, and it was such an important thing to people back then.
Mm-hmm. So the professor had a book.
Yes, I think it was called Here on Gilligan's Isle, and my friend Steve Cox, who he co-wrote it, and Russell, he was such a nice guy. And in the book, it's funny because remember I told you about the cruise that we took? Mm-hmm. Russell my picture is in his book of Bun and I giving when we met up with them on that cruise and gave Don that honeybee tip pin. So they actually used our picture in the book, which is pretty cool.
That's awesome.
That was my big claim to fame for many years.
And so you had a thing with him. You gave him something.
Oh, my God. That was so bad. I know that I've changed a lot and I've matured a lot over the years, although I still pride myself on being immature. When I lived in Chicago, I started a company called Dearly Departed long before the tour company, and I was making T-shirts and tombstones and keychains, et cetera. And I made this one shirt. I called it the obituary shirt, and it was literally headlines from obituaries. Like there were 100 of them on this, all in different. You know, arrangements, and Humphrey Bogart dies, and Marilyn dies, Pills near, and there had to have been, you know, a whole lot of them. So I gave it to celebrities that were doing appearances. I know. So
did you ever get any positive reactions to that?
Well, I did. You know, Judy Tenuta, she called it Fashion Fox Goddess Gear, but I don't think she ever really saw what it was. But Russell Johnson, I gave one to him, and he was really nice about it. He's like, oh, well, as nice as I thought he was going to be, oh, thanks, you know, really, thank you. And Steve was with Russell. So after Russell left this thing, he shows the shirt to Steve, and he goes, what is this? And Steve kind of shrugs. He says, it's like being handed a rattlesnake. Somebody handed a rattlesnake to me, which I thought was kind of funny. So I wouldn't do that nowadays, but it was something that I did do, and I own the fact that I did it. So that's my Gilligan story. One of many, many Gilligan stories. I had some cool times with these guys.
So do you ever, obviously you met Don on that trip. Have you ever met Tina?
Luis? No. I used to collect autographs, and I collected everybody's autograph, and I had everyone's but Tina's. And I, you know, wrote to everybody, and Tina, I was pissed, you know, because I would have had them all.
You'd have the whole set.
So when I had Sherwood's book, he wrote a book called Inside Gilligan's Island. I sent it to Sherwood, asking him to autograph it. And I asked him about Tina, you know, I'm trying to get Tina's autograph. What, you know, what can I do? And he says, you know, Tina just doesn't embrace it like the rest of us do. But somehow we must have got to her, because it was like 2 weeks later that I got Tina's autograph, which was really sweet. So
that's nice.
Yeah, they were, you know, Sherwood was a cool. Sherwood had those voodoo dolls made out of, you know, out of gourds in his house. Uh-huh. I mean, sure, of course, he made a fortune off of it. But it's so cool that you know, when somebody does that and embraces it and realizes what they did.
You know, she studied under Meisner. She's a member of the Actors Studio. I think that she just saw herself as a serious actress who had other plans for her career. And maybe very well did. She ran into auditions and things where people wouldn't hire her because she was ginger for the rest of her life. You know, and so I can see maybe she did. There's a legitimate source for some of her bitterness over that. The typecasting and how she felt like being on a show for 3 years defined the rest of her life, basically.
But eventually you come to terms with things like that, and she just never has. Mm-mm. I mean, she did, what, the Stepford Wives?
And she's the only one who never came back for any of the specials of the three
reunion
specials.
She did do the Ross Matthews thing that I mentioned earlier in 88. But yeah, you're right. Yeah. There was always somebody else.
Yep.
And I remember on the Ross thing, she said when they were casting the show, they said the producers wanted a Lucille Ball, Marilyn Monroe type. Mm. And it's like, oh, that's perfect, isn't it? I mean, that describes Ginger Grant perfectly. And Eva Grubb. What was her tweet on the show, by the way, just because.
What was your favorite Gilligan's Island episode?
Oh, definitely the honeybees. Definitely when the mosquitoes landed on the group called the Mosquitoes landed. And the girls put together a girl group. If you watch it, it is like, I don't know. To me, this little gay kid growing up, it was like seeing these girls jam out with go-go boots on and jumping around and singing. That was pretty darn cool.
I think my favorite, I loved the one with when the mine drifts into the their little lagoon there.
Yeah.
That was a great one. And I remember the one where the Japanese, and I think it was like a mini sub, pulls up, the old Japanese World War II soldier lands on the island, and he doesn't know the war has ended.
Yeah, wasn't that like the worst Asian stereotype?
I think it's one they don't play anymore or something, maybe, because, it was pretty bad.
It was like Mickey Rooney and Breakfast at Tiffany's.
It was like that level.
Coke bottle glasses and big buck teeth. Yeah. And oh, my God.
It probably was. If I went back and watched it now, I'd be like, ooh.
I mean, the amount of people that landed on the island and got away.
You know, yeah.
Remember Ava Gabor, or Zsa Zsa Gabor? Landed on the island, and she was an old friend of the Howells.
And usually Gilligan would screw up. They'd be like, oh, I'll help you get back. I'll help you escape. And then Gilligan would screw something up that would make it so they couldn't do that.
They would have murdered him in real life or sent him to the other side of the island where the headhunters were. Another terrible stereotype. But hey, it was the 60s.
Yeah. All right. Well,
That's it.
Is that it?
That's it, I think.
Are we done?
I think
did we make it off the island?
So I guess we'll sign off by saying, so join us back next week, my friends. You're sure to get a smile from these two guys.
And Castaways in Hollywood.
Here on Gilligan's Isle.
Yes.
This has been an episode of the Dearly Departed podcast. Dig up more episodes at dearlydepartedpod.com and on iTunes and Google Play. See you next time.